From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Joining me on the show this week is Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei broke his silence on the country's tentative nuclear accord with world powers. He called America devilish, but he didn't condemn the deal outright. Saying America does not want to be imprisoned by the past, Barack Obama sought to put U.S.-Cuba relations on a new track at a regional summit of the Americas. National security looms large as new contenders joined the 2016 presidential race. Rand Paul, a Republican, modified his anti-war views to reassure voters that he would do what it takes to protect America from Islamic terror. And finally, another American city, this time in South Carolina, is on edge after a white police officer shot an unarmed black man dead. Cell phone video led quickly to murder charges for the police officer. So, Tom, Iran is in the news in almost every way you can think of at the moment. It's doing this tentative nuclear deal with America, but it's also in action in proxy fights across the region. If you're America, you find yourself sometimes fighting alongside Iranian-backed forces, sometimes against Iranian-backed forces, while you're trying to negotiate with Iran. Just how complicated is Iran on Barack Obama's radar at the moment?
It's extraordinarily complicated, David, but I mean, at the heart of Obama's geopolitical radar is the deal, which he has been working on for several years. And the supreme leader, the cleric, Mr. Khamenei, has just recently said that Iran will not accept any deal with the United States and the other five major powers unless sanctions are lifted immediately. Well, the conventional wisdom is that Khamenei is playing to his rabid right. He's got to sell a deal with the military, with the hardliners, with other clerics, and we will have to see what immediate sanctions exactly means. I mean, the bottom line is there's no way that the U.S. and the other world leaders are going to allow the sanctions to be lifted immediately in their entirety. That won't happen. So the diplomatic wisdom seems to be that he is posturing for domestic Iranian internal political realities.
And Tom, do you almost get the sense there's a kind of triangle here? You've got Barack Obama on one point of the triangle, a man who wants to stop Iran getting a nuclear bomb and would like Iran to become a more responsible or at least less disruptive force in that region for a whole list of places where Iran could be slightly less unhelpful. So he's on one point of the triangle. On the other is the president of Iran, President Rouhani, who also the Americans seem to think would like Iran to be less of a pariah, would like Iran to maintain its system, but to be able to be slightly closer to the rest of the international community. But then you've got this supreme leader who has the final veto over everything, and we don't yet know whether he wants Iran to be a more normal country, or does he have a vision of Iran as a revolutionary Islamic state whose very identity is bound up in conflict and opposition to America? Is that how you think it plays out?
I think that's very well calibrated, David, but I think the supreme leader, I think there is what I would call an iota of pragmatism to him, because he understands that the sanctions are killing the Iranian economy. And I think he basically wants the Iranian political system to remain in the status quo. I don't see any difference there. But I think he's probably willing to be slightly more flexible than his very hardline statements in recent days would suggest. I think the Iranians like the fact that they are now a major player in the Middle East, in Syria, and places where they're very much in the mix militarily.
Well, that's right. Let's go through the list. So you've got, I mean, one of the other hardline things that the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said was he made some very harsh comments about Saudi Arabia, which is one of the Gulf Arab countries striking insurgents in Yemen. Now, that looks a lot like a proxy war between Saudi Arabia, the great Sunni Muslim superpower, and Iran, the great Shia Muslim regional superpower. They both have their proxies fighting in that slightly godforsaken country, Yemen. And you have the Ayatollah accusing the Saudis of genocide, saying that their airstrikes in Yemen are genocide. You know, he's clearly stirring this as much as he can. But if you look, you've got Yemen, you've got Iraq, you've got Syria. I mean, just where does this leave America?
Well, I think the United States has no choice but to grudgingly accept that kind of reality, so long as the president and the Obama administration are not willing to put American troops on the ground in sizable numbers, I mean, by the tens of thousands, and Obama is not going to do that. So it's ironic that Iran, on some level, is perhaps I wouldn't call it a stalwart of stability, but they are injecting some stability into a very unstable situation. And I think the supreme leader in Iran and his mullahs kind of like the fact that, in their view, they have the Americans somewhat buffaloed and somewhat having to accept the reality of Iran's military and geopolitical muscle in that area of the world.
Now, one of the great things about being American president is you have to be able to multitask. So even as Barack Obama was thinking about Iran and the Middle East, he was also preparing for an unusually important regional meeting in the Americas. Now, it's a classic observation, but I think it's true that America doesn't probably spend enough time thinking about its backyard. I mean, Latin America, Central America doesn't get a tremendous amount of attention in the White House, but every now and then we have this summit of the Americas. Sometimes it's a bit sleepy. Sometimes, frankly, not a great deal happens except a bit of kind of confrontation. You know, anti-American leftist leaders kind of get grumpy at the American president. This time, though, Tom, it looked a bit different as he headed in. Expectations of something different linked to the fact that the Cuban president, Raul Castro, was going to be at the summit of the Americas for the first time. What were people expecting as this summit sort of opened?
Well, as a preamble, David, let me say very briefly that I agree with you about what one politician once referred to as benign neglect by the U.S. towards Latin America. I think this has gotten worse since the United States pulled out of Panama in 1999 when the canal was handed over to Panama and American military forces left. On this particular trip, I think the dynamic has changed. The Obama administration, as we all know, wants to change the dynamic with Cuba. The State Department has finished its review of whether Cuba should be taken off the international terrorism list. A recommendation has not been made to the White House, but I suspect in fairly short order the administration is going to take them off that list. Obama wants to engage.
And let's talk about the domestic American implications of that opening up to Cuba. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie of The Economist, and joining me today is Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And now, this program announcement.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcast. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
So, Tom DeFrank, we have Barack Obama laying out, as he often does, you know, the thing that he wants to do is just purely logical. It's got nothing to do with politics. So he says, you know, if you've been trying a policy for 50 years and it doesn't work, in the case of America's Cuba embargo, then it's clearly logical that you should try something different. Does everyone in Washington agree that it's a matter of pure logic opening up to Cuba and there's no politics to be considered?
Well, there's never an issue that I can recall, David, in almost 50 years in Washington where politics was not a component somewhere. Obama does believe this is a rational situation, but there is a political component, and not everybody agrees that this is a good thing. Republicans, especially what I would call the far right of a center-right Republican Party, is very much opposed to any engagement with Cuba. But I think for the most part, political reality has changed in the United States, and there's more support for engaging with the Cubans than there was before. And so I do not think this is going to be a huge there will be a huge political backlash against Obama and or against Hillary Clinton, but we'll come to her later. I think the country is ripe for the proposition that 50 years of hard line towards Cuba, except for its defecting Major League Baseball players, has not worked. So let's do something else. I think, frankly, the most interesting thing about the Summit of the Americas was the overture to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's true Venezuela is a major source of foreign oil for the United States. But since the death of Hugo Chavez a couple of years ago, I think the U.S. government is trying to instigate a rapprochement. And the fact that a senior State Department official would go to Venezuela and meet with a foreign minister.
At the request of the Venezuelans, we understand.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I think that's that could be even more momentous theoretically than even the outreach to Cuba.
And Tom, do you think it's in some ways a sort of test of seriousness of the Latin American leaders at the Summit of the Americas? Because you can say, you know, Barack Obama is going there. He's taking some degree of risk to reach out to Cuba. There are some left-wing leaders of some countries in Latin America who seem willing to go back to the kind of, you know, back to the future. They want to do a kind of 1970s style anti-imperialist, anti-gringo attack because America did impose some extra sanctions on Venezuelan leaders. There was some standard legal language that had to be submitted to Congress here in Washington about Venezuela being a threat to American national security. And certainly the Venezuelan leader, who's got, let's face it, a lot of problems domestically, a crashing economy, rationing shops with empty shelves. He's doing the classic trick of blaming America for all his woes. And some of the leaders at the summit seem to be willing to play the summit this way. Do you think it's a test of seriousness if they go down that route?
I think it is a test of seriousness. But I think, basically, David, I think all of the combatants, if you will, are suddenly interested for various reasons in wanting to engage more, wanting to look more respectable, more responsible, more serious world players. And so I think it's a positive development, however it sorts out.
And of course, as we discussed earlier, this is going to play into the presidential race. Appallingly, for some people, it's nearly 582 days to the next election. But it's already 2016. You may think it's April 2015, but it's already 2016 here in Washington. And national security is looming large. Foreign policy is looming larger than usual. I mean, obviously, the economy is going to be pretty important, but we have a whole host of people joining the fray. We had Rand Paul this week making a series of announcements. He stood in the shadow of an aircraft carrier and sort of slightly distanced himself from his, you know, sort of anti-war-ish sort of views of the past, you know, his concerns in the past about don't use American military force. Now he suddenly is making more hawkish noises, becoming more of a conventional Republican. Do you think, as you look at the 2016 sort of field taking shape, Tom, that national security will be a factor in this election?
Well, the Republicans will try to make it a serious issue in this election. They have been arguing for almost since the day Barack Obama was inaugurated that he is weak, that America is perceived as an unreliable and unsteady partner around the world, and that to use the phrase that has gotten some notoriety on the Republican side, Obama allegedly has been leading from behind. So the Republicans are going to try to do that. They're also going to come after Hillary Clinton for her stewardship in the ill-fated Benghazi situation when an American ambassador and other American diplomats were killed by a Libyan mob.
And you could see some presidential contenders actually just saying, you know, the Obama-Clinton foreign policy
has failed.
Right. So they clearly have an interest in hanging its sort of failures around her neck.
Right. I don't think the Democrats, I don't think it'll be as big an issue for the Democrats. They can talk bread and butter, the rich get richer under Republican theology and the poor get poorer, but the Republicans are going to push very hard to make foreign policy a wedge issue.
Well, exactly. And now, Tom, here's a question for our listeners sort of around the world. Is it that we're back to the kind of George W. Bush era where there is a large kind of pro-war camp itching to start new ground wars in the Middle East, to start bombing Iran? Or is it in fact that the Republicans actually have rather similar policies in some ways to Barack Obama? It's just foreign policy for them is a stick with which to beat the president. It's not that they have a fundamental desire to go to war, like sort of a war party. It's that this is a way of framing the president as a sort of feckless, naive, bad leader. Is that what it's
That's
about?
Exactly right. The country is war weary. I have said for years, probably 25 years, that America is basically all right with wars as long as a lot of Americans don't get killed. Well, a lot of Americans have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, and so the country is weary of war. They want these military entanglements to end, but they do understand that there's going to have to be a more muscular military response to what's going on in the region now.
And can you say, I mean, if you look at the polling, it's interesting that so a year ago there was a lot of polling that this country was, as you say, war weary and just was not interested in seeing American forces engaged overseas. Do you think that the beheading of Americans last year by the fanatics of Islamic State changed that somewhat? That even if this country is still, you know, unwilling to try and reshape the Middle East into a kind of democratic paradise, that more Americans now say that they want to feel safe, that they don't feel safe. And so they want something, maybe not something very optimistic and sort of sunny, but they just want America to be a bit sort of scarier and more threatening to America's enemies. Is that
absolutely? It's what absolutely. The beheadings, I think, were a seminal moment for most Americans. That changed the dynamic. And as I said, the American people and the U.S. Congress are not going to support massive infusions of American military troops in that region, but they will support a few more thousand troops, especially special forces, CIA forces, because they are scared. They don't want to see beheadings at shopping malls in the United States. So they are very worried about the rise of ISIS.
And in just a second, Tom, I'm going to ask you whether you think that Hillary Clinton, assuming that she enters the race very, very soon, perhaps over the weekend, whether she's going to run to Barack Obama's right on foreign policy. But before that, first a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie of The Economist, and joining me today is Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And now, this program announcement.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwae Thompson on Nightline Africa Weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
So, Tom, we have a growing field of Republicans, a very large field now. We've got Rand Paul has thrown his hat in the ring, Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, very hard line. We're expecting Marco Rubio, a senator from Florida, Cuban-American, which we'll play into that. He's going to announce on Monday. And Hillary Clinton announcing any minute now. And, of course, she was Barack Obama's first Secretary of State. She has more foreign policy experience than any of her Republican rivals. Now, the Republicans seem pretty confident that, on balance, foreign policy is going to be their issue this time around, that it's going to be a stick with which to beat Hillary Clinton. Do you think they're 100% right? Do you think that they can tie Hillary Clinton to this kind of lead weight of Barack Obama's foreign policy? Or do you think that she's actually quite savvy and she'll in some ways even run to Barack Obama's right and distance herself from his foreign policy?
Yes, the latter is true in my view, David. I think that she has to distance herself without overtly trashing the person she worked for, as Secretary of State, for 4 years. I believe it's really interesting. I had breakfast this week with a prominent Republican activist fundraiser who says, my party is convinced that Barack Obama is such a dead weight for 2016 that he will bring down Hillary Clinton, he will bring down Democratic senators, that he has so poisoned the well that he is our not-so-secret weapon. And this guy says, we're crazy. He says, we're crazy. He said, African Americans are not going to abandon Hillary Clinton. Her husband was famously once described as America's first black president, Bill Clinton. And so this guy, who is a really smart, savvy Republican partisan, says, we are putting too many eggs in the basket of beating Obama over the head. He said he is not going to end up – he will be a drag on Democrats, but he will not be the total drag, the Republicans believe he will be, but that's not going to stop our party from going full bore down that road.
And just finally, briefly, I mean, Hillary Clinton, can she make a reasonable case that she is a bit more hawkish, a bit less cautious than President Obama on foreign policy?
Oh, yes. I think there is a case there. And there are records that she wanted to be more muscular in Afghanistan and other places.
Syria, she wants to arm the moderate rebels in Syria a couple of years ago.
Exactly right. And I think you can be sure that in the many months ahead until November of 2016, her partisans are going to be reminding us that she wanted to do this, Obama didn't do it.
So you think we could see a dynamic where Hillary Clinton kind of runs classic Clinton thing, the third way down the middle, you say, not the kind of hubris, bomb everything, George W. Bush, not the slightly too cautious Barack Obama, I'm the kind of middle path.
Not too strong, not too weak, just right in the middle. Exactly
Goldilocks
right.
Goldilocks porridge.
It's what right, exactly right. Goldilocks is porridge, and it's the whole strategy that her husband Bill Clinton made famous, and the word triangulation.
We're going to be hearing more about triangulation, I think. Now, just to bring back the discussion at the end to home matters, something tragically familiar, but something different. So we have tragically once again. An American city, North Charleston in South Carolina, is on edge because an unarmed black man was shot dead by a white police officer in what should have been a very routine stop for just a faulty brake light on his car. But it's different this time, isn't it, Tom? Because this time we had cell phone video taken by a passerby and released, and it was so incredibly open and shut that the policeman has not only been fired, he's also been charged with murder, and no one seems to be defending the policeman. So it's not like the big, bitter, very partisan rows that we remember previous instances of shooting deaths like Ferguson, Missouri. What does this tell us about the role of video and where this debate is going in terms of white policing and black citizens?
Well, this is a real setback for policing, especially. It basically demolishes one of the cardinal precepts of policing for decades. Minorities have said police officers have been told, say you feared for your life and you won't be charged.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting that this police officer tried to say he feared for his life. The victim, according to the police officer, grabbed his taser, his stun,
yeah, the electric stun gun. Thing.
But the video shows quite the opposite. In fact, it shows the dead man being shot in the back while running away
eight times. People may have seen the video on the internet. It is unbelievably cut and dried, isn't it? And you've seen Republican senators from South Carolina, a very conservative state, immediately condemning the police officer, saying it's one presidential candidate calling it an execution. Tom, what does this tell us about the role of citizen journalism, if you like? You know, these cell phone videos that are ubiquitous. Is this going to make a surprisingly big difference to the politics of policing in America?
I think so. And I think it's going to give more impetus to a movement that we've seen for some time, but it was especially escalated in the wake of the Ferguson, Missouri incident, where an unarmed black man was also killed, but not while running away. You're going to see more pressure on more police cameras being
mm-hmm.
placed
body
in cars, body cameras
yeah.
on officers. And I'll tell you, just to be cynical for a moment, David, I think you're going to also see police officers look around more carefully mm-hmm. when they do these sorts of things to see if anybody's recording
them.
Well,
let's hope sunlight is the disinfectant that it can so often be. That's all the time we have. And joining me today was Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Jackson Witt. I'm David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.